All right, welcome to the Zone Physical Therapy and Sports Lab podcast. I am your host, Scott Kaler, and I am really excited today because we have Dr. Kip Covington of South Carolina Dental Sleep and TMJ joining us. Welcome, Kip.
It's awesome to be here.
Yeah, this is a long time coming for us and recording it, so I'm really glad to have you in the lab today.
Yeah, and it's been a long time of us just sitting down and having these conversations in general, so I'm excited.
Yeah, I think today's going to be a really interesting episode for our listeners that they're going to get introduced to some ideas that are maybe foreign to them or haven't considered yet. So I think it's going to be a really fun deviation from some of the running that we've been talking about in recent episodes and really get into the longevity and some of the health stuff that this podcast is aimed to gear toward.
Yeah, who's your typical audience?
Yeah, that's a great question. Probably right now, just like my mom and my mother-in-law.
Hey, guys. Got it.
No. So right now, we get a lot of our runners. We have our running lab here, and so we get coaches from all over the state that have reached out to ask some questions. Our local running clubs are our typical audience, but yeah, we're trying to reach a broader audience just on this topic of health. So
love it.
Hopefully this will help us to expand and get more out into the community.
Well, that can shape some of the conversation too. So, in our office, we treat not all kinds of stuff. We're pretty limited in treating sleep and TMD issues. But for your runners, looking at recovery, and that's been Whoop's entire basis, right? I don't know how many people you have wearing Whoop's, but that was fascinating when I started listening to their CEOs and how they were using sleep as a tool for athletics because of recovery.
Yeah, it's huge. Yeah, so we talk recovery all the time with our clients that come in, and it's just a huge need. And certainly tech is big in the endurance world, so Whoop bands, Garmins, you name it, they have it, and they're looking at it. How we interpret it isn't always being utilized, so hopefully today's episode will help us in that. Why don't we start with the fact that you're a dentist and you help patients with sleep issues. Tell us more about how you got into that and what that means.
Yeah, so I landed in this world almost, you could call it accident or fate. The reality was dentistry, you get into dentistry and you go 4 years and you come out and you're like, all right, this is what the rest of my life looks like, and you either love it or you don't. And fortunately, I enjoyed it, but I didn't love it to the point where I actually thought about getting out of dentistry. I don't know if I ever.
Oh, wow. That. No, I didn't know that.
There's something about it with my personality. A lot of dentists are type A, which makes for good dentists because it's a procedural based. You want your surgeons to be very type A, right? I'm not. as you know. So it started literally with a patient or two asking me if I could help with their snoring. And I'm like, do you realize you're asking your dentist? And that happened over and over again that I was so intrigued by that. And so I was like, I got to go take a course somewhere. I'm interested in why I'm being asked this. And at that point it was like, hey, there's a mouth guard out there to help with snoring. And, so I went and sat through a 3-hour lecture in Atlanta, and I wasn't one to go to these types of lectures, but something drew me there. And it was the speaker, who is now a very close friend of mine, 9 years later, spoke in a way that answered all these questions that dentistry didn't answer. So like why we clench and grind our teeth, everything in dentistry is all about bite and how teeth fit together. And for a lot of that just didn't make sense to me. It didn't seem like common sense. So I sat through this lecture and I just swallowed every word that he was saying. I was like, this makes so much more sense than what I got in 4 years of school about some of the questions that I had that didn't have answers to. And I'm sitting next to my partner, and I was like, was that not the most interesting lecture you've ever heard? She was like, oh, it was okay. I was like, how did we not just hear the same thing? To the point that I walked up to the lecturer afterwards, and I said, hey, that was probably the most interesting 3 hours of conversation I've ever listened to pertaining our career. I said, where can I go learn more? And he's like, well, there's not that many places to learn. He's like, but we're starting a study club. There's about 20 of us in the country. Would you be interested? And I was like, heck yeah. And it was on Zoom, and this was before Zooms were Zoom, and I was probably younger by 30 years than everybody else. And so I was just taking in all this information. And then there started being, this became this little niche field of sleep dentistry, which is a terrible terminology, like we were saying earlier. It's like, so everybody asked me, do you put people to sleep to do the dentistry? I'm like, no, we help people sleep better, which is actually a misnomer. We talk about sleep disorder breathing. It's really breathing disordered sleep.
Mm.
So what we're focusing on is helping people breathe better so that they can sleep better. So in your world, so that you can recover better. So my wife's a dentist, and my kids always say, Mom works on teeth and Dad helps people breathe and gives people hope. And I love it. I don't know where they pick that up from. So that's how I sort of entered into that world. And then I couldn't get enough. So then there started becoming credentials to do this. Like, people were like, where did you go learn? I was like, honestly, I'd go anywhere that somebody would take me, because there weren't that many people doing this. So I ended up in Miami, or South Miami, down in Key Biscayne for a week for this really in-depth course. And it was just, again, fate, God's work, that put these people. The guy who helped discover sleep apnea was there. The guy who invented the first dental sleep device. The guy who was doing orthodontic treatment early on to help try to grow some of these people out of these problems. All happened to be at this course, because we sort of had to be, because it was the first course that gave hours towards our accreditation, which wasn't really even a thing. But we all just landed in this place. And I remember calling my wife being like, I just met the Michael Jordan of sleep. And she's like, that is the nerdiest thing I've ever heard. But it got me connected to all these people around the country, well, technically around all the world. And now I can sit and text people and be like, hey, I think we're doing this. Maybe we should be doing it this way. And it's so cool that literally the guy that discovered sleep apnea is still alive. He's in his 90s and he's teaching. He helped invent the first CPAP machine. And now he's saying, why don't we put everybody in something to help stabilize their jaw? So it's just this big world that got made really small really fast. And I love it. And so that led me into you can't treat jaw sleep issues and not understand the anatomy of the jaw joint. And most people, most of your listeners, most anybody around does not understand that dentists don't get any training on TMJ issues. And so what TMJ is, for those that people ask me that all the time, is temporal mandibular joints. So when somebody comes in my office and says, I am TMJ, I'm like, yeah, I have two knees.
I have two TMJ.
Yeah, that's right. There's one on the left, one on the right. but that became, like, in dentistry, like, most dental schools will almost say, like, if somebody has jaw joint issues, refer them somewhere. The problem is where. There is no one out there. So oral surgeons get some training to do surgery, but you don't technically have a orthopedic or a PT of the jaw joint. Like, you guys, you have to go find training to treat this joint, and it is the most complex joint, and it lives in our head. So I don't know if you remember, but when you walked in my office that first day of COVID wearing a mask and saying, hey, do you treat TMJ issues, I was like, who's out here looking for this? Because we're on islands.
That's right.
But the sleep world fascinated me, for it still does. There's nothing, like, when we talk about overall health and wellness and longevity, I look at patients all the time, I'm like, there's nothing I can do to make you worse by having you sleep better.
That's right.
So if we look at risk benefits, there is no risk to sleeping better. But then as I started getting into the TMJ world, which I used to shy away from, it opened up a whole new world of how to treat people who were desperately looking for care that weren't getting answers. And then I realized I couldn't do that alone. That's kind of how where you and I met. And every day I walk into my office and I learn something new, which is awesome.
Well, that's one of the things I really admire about you as a practitioner. And to go back to the beginning of your story, it speaks volumes of the type of environment that you've set up clinically, that a patient asked you about their snoring and you didn't just brush it off. And I really appreciate that. And, you know, that's why we created the space that we're in, and so that we can have those conversations and be able to listen to a patient and go, you know, I don't know the answer necessarily, but I'm willing to go on this journey with you. let's try to figure this out. And it might be connecting you with somebody else, or it might be that I need to go learn a skill so that I can be the one to help you with that. And so I really admire that, because of just being able to see the amount of people now that you've been able to help that otherwise were on an island and felt like they were their own best advocate, or no, that's not the right way to say it, their only advocate, and now they've got someone in their corner. So that's a really awesome journey that you've been on. So thank you for doing that. And yeah, it was, our meeting was kind of interesting the first time we met, to show up in your office in 2020 when people aren't meeting in person, and just being like, hey, we need to work together so that we can help some people feel better.
Yeah, I remember that. Like, it was, well, the Zoom meeting we sat in for 48 hours, essentially, at my desk, masks on, sitting in my tiny little office watching a guy in Lincoln, Nebraska. But the first day I sat in on that, I don't know if you know, but the entire day I was clueless what you guys were talking about.
Mm.
Didn't, like, there were, it was different vocabulary, different, like, I was like, why am I sitting here? This has nothing to do. Like, and I was trying to grasp it, but then it, like, another light bulb went off later on. I was like, oh, you guys are speaking, we're talking about the same things, just totally a different vocabulary. And then I started, that night I went home and I was like, I think I understand. I told Coco, I was like, I think I understand what they're talking about, and it makes so much sense. And I said, I got to learn the vernaculars to look what they're talking about with, you know, we don't use flexion and torsion and all these words and what I do. But then it was like, I remember thinking, how can I be so isolated thinking about this joint, the way it relates to the rest of the body? And now I go to these conferences and they're like, hey, you got to see how the foot's pronated. And I'm like, oh, I know. I said, I just have teams that can do that better than I can. So,
yeah, the collaboration is fun. And I was probably just as confused sitting in that. And the course that he's talking about was through the Postural Restoration Institute. And I'm, as a PT, sitting in a dental occlusion course. I think that was the one.
Yeah, the first one was cervical resolution, I think.
Oh, did we do the cervical resolution first? Okay. Well, that makes more sense why you were confused. Okay, that's right. So then later I went to a dental course, and then I was in the same boat that you were in. Like, I have no idea what you guys are talking about with the way the teeth touch.
I felt real comfortable with that one.
That's right. I got my order of operations mixed up there. Yeah, that was a fun course. But then it was really fun for you and I to be able to have those conversations, for you to go, oh, well, when I see this, you're seeing that, and I can do this with them while you do that simultaneously, and look at this outcome that we can get to. So that's really fun. So I'm gonna keep us moving along here. From a sleep standpoint, tell us why breathing at night is such a big deal.
Yeah. We'll go there, and we'll also go where some of this is my own personal opinions, but on how we may be measuring sleep wrong.
Mm.
So when I got into this sleep apnea, so the term sleep apnea, maybe not the best terminology. Sleep apnea was, the definition is, apnea is stopping breathing, and stopping breathing while we're sleeping. So literally when I started treating patients, and I'm screening for patients in the dental chair, I would send them to get sleep studies, and I would get phone calls back saying, this patient does not have sleep apnea. I'm like, how do you know? And they're like, because they're not fat and old and they're not male. Those were we had a questionnaire. It was basically, are you 65, old, fat, male? And I was like, well, their spouse tells me they're gasping in their sleep or things like that. So anyways, I was on a Zoom meeting this weekend or Tuesday, and there was a sleep physician up in Tennessee who happened to be in China while I was doing the Zoom meeting, and he's trying to redefine how we score this. And there's some other people doing the same thing. But the issue with sleep breathing is you can snore or not snore and have arousals or disruptions in your sleep. And the big kicker is norepinephrine. Okay. So if we shouldn't be secreting norepinephrine in our sleep, right? We should be resting well. Mm-hmm. So when you have this, let's back up a second. We were all like, let's talk about clenching teeth, because this is how I entered this world a little bit. It's like, we clench teeth because we're stressed. That was what I was always told in dental school. It's like, you're stressed, you clench your teeth at night. And I was like, that's got to be bogus. Why are we stressed in sleep? The purpose of sleep is to de-stress us. So then you start monitoring what's happening in sleep, and I used to spend the night in labs and watch these things. And you would see when somebody would have a breathing disruption. Didn't have to be apnea. You don't have to stop breathing. Using that terminology almost keeps people from going and getting tested because they're like, I don't stop breathing. But you can slow down breathing enough and have turbulence in the airway that can cause a norepinephrine release, which causes an arousal. The problem with that, I'm talking about recovery and things and just sleep quality and brain fog, is our body is designed to go through different sleep stages all night long. So we go through light stages, we go through deep stages, we go through REM sleep. So most people hear about REM sleep and deep sleep. REM sleep is almost like rebooting your brain. Deep sleep's like allowing your body to restore from the ridiculous marathons you have people run. So if we don't get in those proper sleep stages, then the body's not going to recover or the brain's not going to recover like we want it to. And we've got all kinds of research that links poor sleep fragmentation. That's a word I like to use, is if the sleep is fragmented, then you're going to have issues long term with brain health, cardiovascular health. Now then the apnea is how much we're stopping breathing. So when we're just measuring apnea, we're missing a whole bunch of people. Because you can have, it's almost like saying we're not going to treat hypertension until you're severely hypertensive. Like, let's not treat pre-hypertension. Like, we don't do that. Well,
it's becoming a thing. Yeah.
Right. So what's happening and what we think, there's a lot of variables that can cause sleep disorder breathing. Weight can obviously, that was the big one at first. It was like, well, this is linked with obesity. Well, I got people that have no weight issues at all that have severe sleep apnea. And they're like, well, they can't have sleep apnea. I'm like, well, they actually have really small jaws. They're like, what are you talking about? Well, the airway starts at the face, right? Mm-hmm. So if our jaws are smaller, the airway is going to be smaller from the start. If our nose is smaller, which is upstairs of our jaws, the airway is going to be small. So a lot of what I do in my office is we're trying to essentially put a Band-Aid on a small airway and open it up. So from a dental perspective, and we'll talk about the different options for treating sleep issues, the gold standard forever has been a CPAP machine. And a CPAP machine stands for continuous positive airway pressure. And so how this was invented is they started seeing the airway collapsing, particularly when people were in the hospitals, like tongues falling back, airways collapsing, people stop breathing. And so a friend of mine drove by a vacuum cleaner store called Eureka. And he goes, Eureka, I can just turn the pump backwards and blow open the airway. And he was a pulmonary researcher, so it made sense, like using a ventilator. So the CPAP was invented from a vacuum cleaner, so I've been told. And so by putting pressure in the airway, you can keep it from collapsing. The problem with CPAP is half the people that get it will tell you if the house is burning down, the first thing they're grabbing is their CPAP. The other half will burn down their CPAP. Mm. So, I'm just kidding.
Oops. We'll just give you an applause on that one.
No. But, I have dental patients, they're like, why are you only doing dentistry one day a week? I'm like, I'm treating sleep issues. They're like, oh, you make CPAP machines. I'm like, no, I make alternatives for people that can't use it. And the ones that love their CPAP, they looked at me and they're like, you can't have a job because this is the best thing on life. Like, this is, people love their CPAP. But half the population hate it. And my belief is the ones that hate it, it actually causes more sleep fragmentation. And so they're getting disrupted sleep while trying to treat the issue. So the side effect outweighs the advantage of the effect. So dental devices are just simply doing CPR. So if you bring your lower jaw slightly forward, you're going to open the airway. That's our first step in CPR. If I'm in the OR and somebody is sedated and we need to open their airway, you're bringing the jaw forward. Yep. And where that comes from, what I believe is most of us were designed to have big, broad jaws. God gave us room for 32 teeth. In the dental world, it is darn near hard to find somebody in a modern society that has room for 32 teeth. So our jaws are getting smaller, and there's theories on that's because of diet or mostly diet, but some other factors that could be causative. But the reality is our jaws are getting smaller. And when I was in dental school, they were like, well, we're evolving to not need wisdom teeth. And I was like, that sounds stupid. But that's my
Your memory. Professors had to love you.
I kept those things to myself. Okay. But internally, I would struggle with some of these things. And so that became, now dental devices are becoming a treatment for sleep disorder breathing. And then you've got now surgeries popping up, and some of the surgeries that were being used in the 90s and 2000s were a little bit barbaric. They're going in and saying, hey, if the airway's got stuff falling in it, let's just start cutting stuff out. The ultimate end all surgery for sleep apnea, I tell people, is jaw surgery. It's like, let's make the jaws bigger. But it's got its risks, and nobody's wanting to run out and sign up for jaw surgery. But it's so interesting. If you talk to people who have had jaw surgery or even some nasal surgeries to improve sleep breathing, they won't just say, I breathe better in my sleep. They will say, I breathe better all the time, right? So none of us can compare how we breathe to how we're supposed to breathe.
You just know what you know.
You're right. So it's like when I get people sleeping better, oftentimes it's like when somebody puts glasses on for the first time, they're like, oh, this is how I'm supposed to see? And then they lose whatever we do, and they're like, hey, you made me worse. And they're like, no, we made you back where you were. We just made you realize what good was like. Right. So now every time I open up an email, I'm getting emails about drugs that are going to be treating sleep apnea. The problem is there's so many causes. Like, you could have a lot of it can be musculature, poor muscular tone. So if we can strengthen muscular tone, you can keep the airway from collapsing so much. But some of it's just poor anatomy. And some of it's weight, like, so that you can tackle these issues all these different ways. But the problem with us in medicine right now is like, we'll throw one thing at it. We're like, oh, if that doesn't work, let's move to the next. And this has to come from teams. And like, so I have patients that are on multiple treatments, and they're like, this is my treatment. I got a CPAP machine, I'm wearing a dental device, and I'm sleeping on my side. Like, yeah, until you're not 400 pounds, that's probably your best option. But the orthodontic world is really fascinating right now, as we're understanding that small jaws is a part of this problem. So how do we make the jaws bigger without surgery? And that's hard to do on fully grown adults. But we're seeing it in children, and people are pushing the limits on adults. And then we have a whole world out there of basically airway PTs, which are myofunctional therapists, which, you know, we work with them a lot. And I almost think that everyone out there needs some myofunctional therapy training, but it's how to train the tongue to swallow appropriately, where to rest the tongue, which would bode well for somebody who's running and to nasal breathe. And I've seen this firsthand. So, like, I get to go to Kenya a good bit. You're about to go.
I leave a week from today as of this recording.
Oh, I need you to carry something for you. The runners in Kenya, you guys know in the running world, like, I am not a runner. So it's funny that you and I sit here and I'm talking about this. For me, running was punishment for every sport I played. But I know well enough to know where the best marathon runners in the world come from. They have big, broad jaws. They nasal breathe darn near most of the race. And then they blow CO2 at the end, I think, is what they do. I learn enough about this. But I get to go there and people run.
That's right.
But their anatomy is conducive to that. So that's what I hope that we start figuring out in modern societies is with kids, is can we outgrow this issue?
Well, that's what we're trying to do with my daughter right now, not to interrupt you, but, you know, from a parenting standpoint, we had our youngest daughter, we just have these, like, literally 4-hour meltdowns at night before bed, and it was just, like, really hard as a parent. And, you know, we're learning how to parent and thinking, is this a behavioral issue? And there's a component of that for sure. But, excuse me, then we realize, as I'm diving into this world with you and some PRI stuff and some other practitioners in town, I'm like, I don't know if she's sleeping at night. I think she has a tongue tie. So we get her evaluated for a tongue tie. She gets a tongue tie release, buccal tie, lip tie release, and goes and works with myofunctional therapy for 6 months. Now she can sleep with her lips closed, tongue on the roof of her mouth, and she's like 90% better on the meltdowns. Now, some of that's maturity, but some of it was like in the moment too. It was like almost night and day within a short amount of time. And as a parent, you feel kind of guilty. You go, man, I was treating a symptom, not the cause. But you do the best that you can with the information that you have at the time. But it was life-changing for our family, for Layton to go through this. And so now she's working with a local orthodontist, and she was 7, like right in that sweet spot. We can do some palatal expansion, tongue can live up in the roof of her mouth beautifully, and just the way that she sleeps so much more peacefully is fantastic. So that's just our personal anecdote of why we get so fired up about people breathing, and especially catching it early.
I had a physician yesterday tell a patient that dentists go out and do tongue tie releases to pay for their fancy lasers, and it's just like, that's like a knife twist in me. Like, you're not gonna, anyways, it's super taboo to talk about right now. So when I teach, I have to kind of gauge the audience and see how open-minded people are to things. But tongue tie releases have not been, they're not a new thing. Midwives kept their fingernails long forever, because if you had a tongue tie and you couldn't breastfeed before we had baby bottles and baby food, you were a failure to thrive. So they would just snip the tongue with their fingernails. But so we think now that this world is like, well, if you can breastfeed, then you're not tongue tied. That's not true either. But my son was a classic case too. I did all that with him, had tonsils and adenoids, and he would go through ways where he would get better and then he wouldn't. And then what I would judge things by is he would have terrible night sweats. So he was sympathetically driven in his sleep. Again, should not be having norepinephrine produced, right? And it really wasn't until, and this is another taboo subject, but I'll say it anyways, I started lip taping him because I knew his airway was, we had already surgically improved his airway and his nose, but yet he was still mouth breathing, and we had done myofunctional therapy and a tongue tie release, but he kept reverting back. As soon as I got him lip taping for 2 months or so, he hasn't had night sweats since then, you know. And the fascinating thing with that is you're getting growth hormones secreted during deep sleep. So back to your audience.
That's right.
If you want to maximize recovery, we've got to get these good sleep stages, which is, again, different than apnea. So there's a big misconception with sleep apnea that your severe cases should be your really symptomatic cases. I actually find quite the opposite. My severe cases are really symptomatic in the fact that they have quadruple bypasses or strokes or things like that, but they don't come in saying I'm tired or I'm fatigued. My mild cases are super tired and fatigued, and they get often mislabeled as saying, hey, well, you have chronic insomnia, or you're just, you even so far as like fibromyalgia, things like that, where in a sense their central nervous system is keeping them from being severe, but by giving up the proper sleep staging where they're more dangerous, because we tend to breathe worse in our deep sleep and our REM sleep, because that's when muscles are relaxed so they can they can heal. But if you can't spend time in those stages, you're never going to be able to recover from 10 miles is nothing for you guys. Whatever
yeah, would be longer. Whatever's long relative to that person. Well, let's camp there for just a second. I would love for you to talk to us about why is nasal breathing so important? Let's stay there for a bit.
Yeah, it depends on who you ask. When I got into this world, we didn't even talk about the nose. I started hanging out with some ENTs up at Harvard that were just cool guys, and they introduced me to all this literature that nasal surgeries, mainly turbinate reductions, sometimes septoplasties, but anything to make somebody breathe better through the nose, had some really interesting research show up that did not decrease sleep apnea that much, but it really improved sleep quality. And that was a problem for everybody, because they're like, no, sleep apnea and sleep quality, they should go hand in hand. So what that did was just open up the idea that the nose is important for more than just apnea, okay? I always tell patients, your nose, God wouldn't have given us this big honking nose if it wasn't important. And it takes up a third of your head. So in terms of size and importance, form follows function, the nose is your HVAC system of your body. It's your condenser, it's your humidifier, it's your filtration system. So if you skip the nose, now your lungs are going to have to work in a way that they weren't designed to work. So there's books written from like the 1920s that show that you could treat asthma with nasal breathing exercises. There's a classic book that was called Close Your Mouth or Shut Your Mouth, and the tagline is stop asthma, hay fever, and chronic sinusitis forever. And it was essentially talking about nasal breathing. And it was a European physician who came over, moved to the U.S. This was actually dating before that, but he saw the Native Americans, as soon as they would breastfeed, they would cover their mouths to make sure that the babies were nasal breathers. And he was like, at the time, these were the these were the world's best athletes. Now, if you look at what our Native Americans are now, it's changed because of diets and what's happened. But at the time, they're riding. They're like, these guys can run forever and chase an Azel or whatever. And they were like, and their facial features are so broad compared to what the Europeans were looking at. And they've done some super interesting studies on monkeys. If you ever Google Harvald monkeys, it's kind of scary of what happens if you take monkeys and you clog their noses up.
Mm.
And leave them that way. Their faces will develop differently. They'll come up with these chronic illnesses, things like that. There's a book that you and I know about called Breathe. Is it Breathe or Breath?
Breath.
James Nestor's book. Great read for anybody listening here, particularly if you're a runner. But James and another pulmonaut, they call themselves, do the study where they actually clog their noses up. Mm-hmm. And in 2 weeks, they develop hypertension, sleep apnea, chronic headaches, things like that. And then they reverse it, and not only do they go back to their baseline, and by just literally lip taping for a couple weeks, they improve those results. So nobody talks about the nose. Most of our pulmonologists in town, if you think about what a pulmonologist does, is they're treating lungs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't think about what's upstream and before the lungs, right? So at the end of that book, James's father says, I've been a pulmonologist my entire life, and I feel terrible that I've never actually taught somebody how to breathe. Mm. I've been treating illnesses, right? And that's our medical model. We treat sickness.
Yep.
So the nose, it's funny you bring that up because I didn't even think we were going to talk about that. Whether I'm treating TMJ issues or sleep issues in my office, I get so many people. I'm like, hey, one of my goals is to make you a nasal breather. And patients will say, well, you're not going to be able to. I said, well, then either walk out of here or we're going to try. With using the dental devices for sleep, when I got into this, it was about how far we could jack the jaw forward. Now, it's how little can I bring the jaw forward so that I can get somebody breathing through their nose. And I'm a firm believer that if I can get somebody nasal breathing, I'll decrease some of that sleep fragmentation and hopefully get somebody into more deep sleep, more REM sleep, so that they can recover.
What's your measure in the office for that?
For nasal breathing?
Yeah, just how much you're going to bring them forward, and then is it more just trial and error when they're giving you some feedback, or is there something you're looking for from their breathing in your office?
Yeah, so I use my own little artistic approach to that. How I got into it and how I used to do it was, we would take somebody's regular jaw position. I look back at this and it almost pains me, but this is how I was trained. We take your jaw position, and I would say, how far can you bring your jaw forward? And we would measure that, and then we would take 70% of that. Who came up with that? I kind of think I know, but that was a range, right? And then my buddy Dr. Rimmers, who helped invent the CPAP machine, invented a dental device at one point that was hooked to a sleep study, and it moved all night. It was awesome until it ran out of funding, and I'll have this expensive paperweight on my desk. But it showed us so much, because you put it on everybody and they would wear it for 2 nights. I used to do it on myself, and it would move your jaw all night long. It would find the therapeutic position, right? There were tons of people that did not need their jaw moved forward. They just needed their jaw not to fall back in their sleep. Mm-hmm. So I tend to start people, if I can get them nasal breathing, just at their natural position. And then if I have to come forward, and a lot of what I do is I have them come forward based on subjective results. Hey, am I snoring less? Am I feeling better? And then I do testing to see where we are along the lines. But no one comes back to my office. Most people don't come back and say, hey, this thing's working because my apnea score is decreased. Because they have no way of knowing that unless they're wearing some type of sleep study. People come back and say, this thing's working because I feel better.
Mm.
And then it's like, well, I need the numbers to make sure that this isn't a placebo. But that's kind of how I gauge things. So I do things different than I used to. I usually take people now at a very comfortable position, because I'd rather people start out very comfortable, and then we'll work towards the effective position while working on nasal breathing. If I have somebody that sits in my chair and I'd have a 5-minute conversation with them and they've never breathed through their nose, I'm getting an ENT to evaluate them, because I can only do so much if I'm only getting them the airway open. So.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. It was a little bit of a tangent, but thanks for going down that road with me there. Yeah, nasal breathing is such a big deal. And, you know, I have a girl that's coming in today, actually, that I'm excited for. She's a cross country and a track runner. I was talking to her mom at church, and she's like, she loves to run, but she feels like she's letting the team down because she's having these asthma issues. We've tried every medication. Mom and dad are both in the medical field, so they understand the medicine side of it. And like, she just can't participate at the level that we know she has the ability to do. And I was like, you know, that's, you know, I do a lot of breathing here in the office. We've got a sign behind Kip right now that says, just breathe. And I was like, you know, I had a runner that came to see me from one of the local high schools a couple of years ago, and he would get 2/3 of the way through a cross-country meet, and you'd have these pre-syncopal type episodes. So he would almost faint before the finish line every event. And so naturally his parents get him worked up through his pediatrician for heart issues and brain issues and lung issues, and every test is coming back normal. He's had his inhaler, he's had, you know, you name it, he's tried it. And so my friend is his pediatrician and calls me, and he's like, is there anything you can do for this runner? Like, he loves running and he can't do it at the level that he wants to. I said, you know, I know this PRI stuff, I know some breathing, let's bring him in. So I look at him, and he's a 100% mouth breather. Doesn't even know that his nose exists on his face other than to maybe smell stuff, right? And we're looking at some posture, and through our assessment in the clinic, realizing like he can't access his airway through his nose. So we do some postural work, help open up his rib cage in some areas that were compressed. And he went on to have the back half of his season. He was hitting PRs, was able to finish out his senior year. And it was just, I can't promise that for every runner that comes through the door. But in that case, it was just so fun to be like, oh man, all we did was put him in a couple of positions that obligated him to breathe into some tight areas that he didn't know how to access originally. And we got him lip taping at night, and we did some nasal breathing warm-ups. Like, said, hey, during your warm-up, I want your lips closed. You can take a quiet breath in through your nose, quiet breath out through your mouth, and then I want you to take as many steps as you can before you have to breathe again. And then on that next breath, when you get real hungry for air, it needs to be in through your nose. I want you to do that 10 times before you start your workout. And it changed this young man's life from a athletic standpoint, but you and I would both say it probably is going to help him out in many more ways from a health standpoint.
So, excuse me. Would you call that a nasal unblocking exercise?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So you know my wife. My wife's an ultra athlete, but long distance running she would never do. So when we started looking at nasal breathing exercises, I was like, hey, you need to, she's at Iron Tribe all the time, and I was like, you need to work out with your mouth closed. I didn't know she was working on this. It took her a year to run a mile with her lips closed. So there was a huge CrossFit study on lip taping in Sweden. I need to give that to you.
Yeah, I need to read that one.
And what they found was that if you nasal breathe throughout your workouts, that your recovery, lactic acid, all this was changed. Everything was positive. And this wasn't talking about sleeping. This was talking about working out.
Performance, yeah.
Yeah, and I gave that to the Iron Tribe folks, and they never really paid attention to it. But it's powerful. But you and I have treated probably I saw her yesterday. One of my favorite patients I've ever treated was the patient you prayed for at church, and that we treated together. And we did some, you know, she was a runner and couldn't run because she would have terrible migraines and vomit and things like that. So the complexity of this is the point of this is, I remember one day in my office, like, noticing that her nose, her nostrils collapsed a little bit. And so I put some nasal cones in there and she started crying. And I was like quickly trying to pull them out. And she's like, don't take those out. She's like, this is the first time I haven't had a headache in however many years. And it was as simple as getting her nose opened up. Man, that was fascinating. Fast forward, she ran into some mold issues at her house and everything reverted back. And you're like, gosh, we're dealing with, we have to play Sherlock Holmes with half of our patients, right? Because like you telling me that story of that kid, I'm thinking there's an anatomical feature in his nose that's blocking that. And then to hear you say, hey, we can work on some PRI techniques to open him up and get him nasal breathing. I'm like, oh my gosh, how many patients am I missing that aren't nasal breathing just because their body is restricting them from allowing that. That's fascinating. And everyone's trying to be elite athletes these days, right? So it's but we're missing, half of us are missing the most simplistic approach, and it's how we breathe, because we don't think about it. It's inherent, right? We breathe. We don't, we never think about how we breathe, right? So,
yeah, it's crazy because we don't, we think about it because we've been opened up to it. But like I was having a conversation with the director of a big sports program in town, and I was like, hey, I have one tip for you. Don't change anything you're doing. All I want your athletes to do is in the recovery of their wind sprints is you make them close their lips and breathe through their nose, and they don't do it. He's like, that's weird. I'm like, I said, yeah, but if you want to be able to perform at a high level longer into the game than your opponents, this will set your team apart. I was like, and here's all the studies to show why. Yeah. And it's just funny. I was like, I'm not even trying to change your training regimen. I was like, just teach your kids to breathe a little bit differently, but one day this will catch on.
Well, you know, the world's small, and I have a family member who's very involved in high-level baseball, and we had, you know, talked about some of the PRI techniques mm-hmm. and breathing, and particularly for pitchers, and he sends me a picture. He's down in the Dominican. He's like, I guess you were right. All these guys are blowing up balloons and doing these stretches. I was like, I told you. I was like, you need to look at how these people's bodies will allow them to move. And I caught that early on in the TMJ world. I had docs around the country making dental devices to change mobility, particularly for football players. And, you know, there's a whole world out there of sport orthotics, dental orthotics, and how you can change posture. And you and I need to kind of revisit on that at some point. But it's fascinating what the body will do when you allow it to move how it's supposed to move, right?
Yeah, so like with our movements is we are taking input in from all sorts of different systems. So we're getting input from the way our feet touch the ground. We're getting input from the way our teeth touch, our inner ear for balance, the visual field that we have, and our brain has to process all of that. If there's any alteration in our cervical spine that's limiting our ability to conduct those messages, we don't get the best output. So that's where when we can come up with an orthotic or a program for somebody to get their neck to relax so that these nerve signals can flow like they're supposed to, we get this like this better output. And so like I'll use myself as an example from a patient standpoint. Like if I am not great on my nasal breathing and being consistent with some of my rehab exercises given some of the ways that I move, like my runs are just slower. I spend a week working hard on doing some postural work and some breath work, and all of a sudden I can go run 30 seconds a mile faster at an easier pace or like an easier feel.
Yeah,
and it's just fascinating to me. Like it's just taking the parking brake off when we can help somebody breathe through their nose and get them in a good postural position. And when I say the word posture, that'll be another episode, but I don't just mean like militaristic stand up straight. It's like, can you maintain an airway on a neck that's relaxed with a body that can move underneath it left and right and forward and back without having to strain? And so can you get into the position that activity demands without compensating and do it easily and breathe into it?
Yeah, so when it comes to treating my TMJ patients, I still, to this day, every patient I put into it, we call them orthotics because they're not night guards. They're not, if I'm trying to heal a joint that's popping or clicking or has been dysfunctional, we're not putting somebody in a piece of plastic just to clench on, right? So totally different world than handing somebody a night guard. And most of my patients come and they're like, hey, I already had like 4 night guards from my dentist. And I'm like, yeah, what I'm going to make you is also plastic, but it's totally different. But anyways, when I make these devices, I still, to this day, every patient, I check their neck movement, because you taught me that. And if I know that I have their lower jaw in a position that their neck allows them to move, I know that I'm already a step ahead of where they were, right? So I was up in Indiana a couple weekends ago and learning from a buddy of mine that has a whole different approach. He does a lot of cranial nerve reflex testing. And so he checks his orthotics to, like, stand somebody up. And if their jaw's in the wrong position, you can essentially push them over, right? And if the jaw's in the right position, it's like your body is allowing you to have those reflexes. It's the same thing you taught me. If the neck's in a neutral position, so are the cranial nerves, which controls everything. And we're talking toes, right?
Yeah.
So he's sitting there, and this is over everybody else's head, like what he's trying to explain. I was like, no, that makes total sense. But I'm just looking at it because you taught me to look at it purely from a neck standpoint. So it was cool to connect those dots.
Oh, that's awesome.
But yeah, so.
Yeah. There's a test that I'm going through, a Con Ed course right now through a group where it's all about how the jaw relates to posture. It's really fun. Mm-hmm. It's just building on this PRI stuff that I've been learning over the last 15 years. And there's a test in our world called a Romberg test where you stand with your feet together, you hold your arms out, close your eyes, and you assess if the patient can maintain their balance mm-hmm. or not. And so they do this test, you can, and you're trying to tease out what is the cause of their imbalance or why they lose their balance. And this PT, I think she's a PT, is developed her own version of this test where she rolls up gauze, mm-hmm. puts it between the patient's teeth and has them put their tongue on top of it. So the tongue's up and it's where it's supposed to be in the roof of the mouth, taking the bite out of it. And then if your balance changes and they can maintain it, you're like, ah, you have a jaw issue.
Yeah.
And so then we can refer or guide our program around the jaw or help with an orthotic of some kind. It's really fun.
And that makes total sense to me. Now.
That's right.
You would have said this to me 5-10 years ago. I'm like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. This has been a fun conversation. And what I'm excited about is that we're probably going to do lots of episodes together. I do want to hit on one more topic for this episode, and then we'll definitely get back together and dive more into the world of TMJ and sleep. But for anybody listening in this episode, how can they get better sleep tonight?
Yep, that's what everybody wants to know. So I have my own versions of this. I'm sure we're on a podcast. One of my favorite podcasters is Dr. Huberman.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you listen to him. Yep. I'm sure everybody out here probably knows who he is. But for what I know of him, he was a neuro-ophthalmology researcher early on at Stanford. Eyes are cool, but they're not as cool to talk about as people love sleep, right?
Right.
So anyways, he's dove into the world of sleep. So I love the stuff coming out of Stanford University because Stanford is one of the – Stanford, Harvard, sometimes UCLA are like the sleep meccas. So anyways, he's at Stanford, so we got to link up with all this stuff. So I use a lot of his sleep tips, and I actually share them with patients. So he's got a bunch, but I'll kind of highlight a few that have been important for me. And sometimes I'm a hypocrite about this because I don't always get to do this, but he has a perfect day, and I think no one else can do that because he's a researcher and he has a lot of flexibility. But some big ones, and these go down to how God designed us to be, but one of the big ones is you want to see sunlight first thing in the morning. And that's hard to do if you wake up prior to the sunlight, but it's to get outside. And as hard as that is for me, you want to get true sunlight for the first 30 minutes or so, if you can. The one I try to focus on patients with a lot, so like, again, back to the sleep fragmentation, I want people to get the best REM sleep and deep sleep as they can. So if you can biohack that in any way, we want to take advantage of that. And the best way to biohack REM sleep is to stay on the same sleep schedule. Hard in our society, but if you can go to bed at the same time and wake up at the same time routinely, and that involves weekends too,
mm-hmm.
I'm my own worst enemy there, but you will stay in REM sleep longer. Caffeine's a big one. Everybody, you know, caffeine's the number one drug in the world, and I always go back to that. It's like we're sitting here drinking coffee.
As I'm taking a sip of coffee, as you say that.
Yeah, so caffeine has a long half-life. The reason I always ask, like, why is it the most commonly used? I think we're all sleeping bad. We just don't know it, so we're all just amping ourselves up with caffeine. But caffeine, two things on it. You don't want to drink caffeine in the afternoon, which most people can relate to that. But here's what I didn't know until I started listening to some of his research was you ideally don't want caffeine the first 90 minutes of your wake. Most of us will wake up and immediately get caffeine. Then you hit this crash afterwards, and it has all to do with our adenosine receptors and things. But if you can push off caffeine for the first hour and a half, you will feel better throughout the afternoon. So that's one that I was like, the first time I heard that, I was like, oh. And the way he went through the science, I was like, oh, that makes sense. But I would have never thought about that, right? So
you just rained all over my wife's morning routine.
It was my morning routine. So I had to change up my morning routine. And some of the longevity stuff has changed up my morning routine too. So I try to do my zone 2 workouts. And if I do that, then I'm already pushed myself out by the time I shower and stuff. Another one is people, so insomnia and getting to sleep can sometimes be hard to deal with, but it's normal to feel alert before you fall asleep. So I tell people don't freak out on that. There's all kinds of apps out there that I'm happy to share at any point that can help with insomnia. Alcohol is a big one. Alcohol completely disrupts the sleep architecture. People will, you know, the hangover is real, but it also, like Tylenol PM has alcohol in it. They will sometimes make people feel like they can sleep easier, but they sleep worse. You're trading out longer sleep for crappier sleep, basically. And then there are some supplements people can take. This is a world that I'm starting to get into now. The problem is, like, I'll get patients, I treat their sleep apnea, and based on the numbers, they should be feeling better. But if they're not, then it's like, what else do we do? And not many people are given options. So tons of people take magnesium. The problem with magnesium is a lot of the magnesiums people are taking over the counter, well, they're all over the counter, but a lot of the versions they're taking are not crossing the brain-blood barrier. So it's not helping get into these deeper sleep stages. So there's a couple versions, and you can check out HubermanLab.com and look at some of his recommendations. But I don't love to dive into the world, because to me, it's not necessarily in my scope, but it's also that gets real complex. Because what if I take magnesium, you take a Epinogen, and somebody else takes theanine? It's going to, we're all going to be different. And so there's a little bit of trial and error with those things, but worth looking at. But then the take home too is if there are so many people out there that aren't breathing well in their sleep, you can use, like, if you're not sleeping with somebody, I am blessed that sleep comes with an alarm system. Okay. What I mean by that is cancer, we usually don't know about cancer until if you don't pre-find it in a test, we find it too late. Okay. Yep. Sleep apnea gives us an alarm system. Usually it comes with some noise or some symptoms of poor sleep quality. So address those.
I like that.
I made that up.
I love it. Yeah. That's a good way to talk to a patient. It's an alarm bell.
Yeah. And so you'll jump on the alarm system here soon, but just snoring, even if it's not associated with sleep apnea, has been shown to increase our risk of cardiac strokes. And that's the thought is vibration of the carotid artery and throwing plaques, but snoring is serious and we all think that it's normal, right? Or, you know, the first time I was in Africa, one of our translators was like, "What is that noise these people are making?" And I was like, "It's snoring." And he's like, "I've never heard that." I was like, it's fascinating. So anyways, those are some take homes for sleep tips. But the big ones I tell people, get on a regular routine. The sleep hygiene tips, we want to sleep like cavemen. Dark, cold rooms. You don't need fancy Tempur-Pedic mattresses that cool off. You just cool down your room. And we want it as dark as possible. All lights out. And there's even some research out there that we don't want any electricity in a room. I haven't quite gone there myself, but I've debated it because that gets kind of out there. But
yeah, no, I think that's great. I know for me, I've been lip taping for the last 2 years, and it's the best sleep that I've ever had. And I used to think that I slept well, but I just slept hard,
yeah,
but not actually well. And then it's probably going to embarrass my wife, I say, but sometimes I'll use an eye mask. Mm-hmm. So I have lip tape,
yeah,
eye mask.
Well, you should see us at our house.
Sometimes earplugs. So, like, I'm just totally sensory deprivation. And those are the nights that I sleep the best.
Yeah.
And even like a little alarm clock light, now I'll notice it in a room, or like a power switch with a little green light. And I'm like, man, now I have to cover these things up because I've been reading too much.
Yeah. Well, and you do. Now, the caution with lip taping is I would call it nasal patency issues. If you have a nose that doesn't work, obviously we don't want to be taping, right? So my test there with patients is lip tape, watch a movie.
Yep.
If you can make it through a whole movie with your lips closed, then you're probably fine to lip tape at night.
Yeah.
My concern is there's going to be somebody out there that ends up having a problem with lip taping. So I don't have a problem with it with my patients because I'm sitting watching them nasal breathe.
Right.
But if somebody's going to use a lip tape, MyoTape's an easy one for people to start with because it actually has an opening.
Yep.
Problem is that some people will still mouth breathe with it.
Yeah. No, that's a great word. And then a tip that I'll use for patients is, hey, just put it on 20 minutes before bed, after you brush your teeth, do your night routine, and just if you feel pretty good while you're doing that, you're probably going to be okay. I know some things change when you're asleep, but that's right. At least a test to get comfortable with having it. But I might take yours and movies a little bit longer, and so they'll know of how they're going to do with it.
Yeah. So, but yeah, this has been great. I look forward to more conversations, and I really look forward to, we got to get back to working together more. Life just gets busy.
Yeah. All right. Well, Kip, thank you so much for being on this episode, and we look forward to having you on a few more.
Thanks for having me.